I would like to ask you a very important question.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. And thank you for joining me today. I am really looking forward to talking with you this afternoon about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Of course, that's what we do every Sunday, 3 to 5 here on Stand to Reason. I'm actually sitting as I speak, but we are, in a sense, in our minds, standing to talk about the critical and important issues of life, the weighty matters, in a way that makes sense. And my responsibility here is to give you a piece of my own mind on those issues, and yours is to give me a piece of yours. 1-800-227-5278 is the number if you're in the 714 area code. Pardon me, that is local to me here in Southern California. You can dial 754-4150 direct to get the enforcer, Melinda Penner, standing by for your calls. Once again, 1-800-227-5278. Or in the 714 area code, 754-4150. I am just at the point about right now that I'm turning off my TV set, even Fox News. I'm tired of the campaign. this is a campaign that I had not followed at all, like for a year and a half until about 3 weeks ago. And then sitting in an airport on Friday morning on my way to Chicago on the weekend just before the Republican convention, I heard news that Sarah Palin had been nominated as vice president. That got me all energized. And so I paid attention for the next 3.5 weeks or 2.5 weeks, whatever it's been. God, it seems like it's been years. And but it's been, well, let's see, today's the 21st, so 3 weeks. That's an eternity. When you have to listen to the kinds of things that we've listened to in the last 3 weeks, so I'm sick of it and I'm done with it. But I want to talk about a principle that relates to this broader discussion. In fact, I want to talk about two things that are related and are especially important ideas during an election season. And the first is on the question of whether God takes sides, and the second is on the issue of partisanship. In other words, arguing for and defending your own side against the other side. And in brief, here are my two basic convictions regarding these two things. First, God does take sides. And second, partisanship is not only good, I think it is morally required precisely because God does take sides. Now, this whole issue of God taking sides comes up every election cycle. And I think about 4 years ago, there was a big article written, a full-page article that says, God is not a Republican. It was an ad. And then it said, yeah, no, he's not a Democrat either, kind of in smaller print. But then the whole article went on to argue in favor of particular views these people who sponsored it believed in that were God's views. That's why they stood for them. And they turned out to mirror at almost every single point the Democratic point of view. So, which is fine if somebody wants to advertise that. I just think it's disingenuous to kind of argue explicitly that God does not take the side of one party or the other and then implicitly argue that he does. But this is really goes to my point. I actually think that God does take sides, and I think that it is appropriate for us to take sides in light of what we think God would think about the issue. In fact, it's not just appropriate, it's morally obligatory. And if such thing is morally obligatory, then it seems to put partisanship, at least one kind of partisanship, in an entirely different light. Now, the bumper sticker I saw the other day basically, well, actually, it said simply, God is not a Republican on the top in big red letters. Then underneath in smaller blue letters, it said, God is not a Democrat either. Frankly, I think that these bumper stickers are either disingenuous, in other words, the people who use them don't really believe them, or they are well-meaning, but they turn out to be silly slogans because the people who use them haven't really thought about what they're saying. All politics, think about this, all politics is and I'm talking about politics here as an enterprise of civilization, politics as such. All politics is moral. The entire debate about politics pursued at least under the American system can be reduced to a single question: what is the proper use of force to accomplish moral ends? And people say you can't legislate morality. Listen, all legislation is moral. If there is not a moral justification for the use of power that you have in mind, then your use of power is illicit. This is what despots do. Aristotle said famously that all law rests upon the necessary foundation of morality. Now note that this kind of thing is a prescriptive notion. In other words, Aristotle is saying that this is the nature of law and government properly construed. It's supposed to be this way, even though we know it's not always this way. When people use something meant for moral ends as a means to immorally consolidate their own power and control over the very people they were entrusted to serve. So sometimes politics is used poorly, but if you take politics as a thing, as such, at least in the American system, the purpose of power is for the public good. And politics is the political enterprise is how do we divvy up that power? How do we use that power to accomplish those things that are good in light of the restraints on power that we have in the Constitution? So the American political enterprise is a moral enterprise. And for those politicians who don't want to legislate morality, they should probably get out of the legislation business, because this is their raison d'etre. This is their reason for existing. And if they are not there to legislate morality that is consistent with the public good, then they're not there for anything at all. They shouldn't be in the business. And since, now think about this carefully, if I'm right about this, since politics is a moral enterprise, the proper use of power to accomplish moral ends, in our case the common good, then it follows that there are right and wrong answers to political questions, if you're an objectivist with regards to morality, because with regards to moral issues, there are right and wrong answers to those objective moral issues. There are moral and immoral responses regarding policy concerns. And if there is a right and wrong answer, morally speaking, since this is a moral enterprise, and if God is concerned about right and wrong, he is, by the way, and if God is always on the side of the right, he is also that, then on any given political / moral issue, God would have a point of view, wouldn't he? In other words, God would have a side, he would take a side. And if it turns out that your take on the political / moral issue is the correct take, then you have taken the same position that God has taken. You share the same view, and you are on God's side, and he is on yours. Now, I don't know how you can avoid that, unless you're a relativist, and then this is all nonsense. But then, if relativism is true, that is, there are no objective moral principles, then all politics turns out to be is a raw exercise of power. And it is the tyranny of the majority. Now, I don't think most people think that. I think we know better. And this is why we object to such tyranny when it's done by the majority, because we realize there can be a moral majority, if you will, of one. A majority of one. That is, one person could be in the right even if everybody else is in the wrong. But that can only be the case if morals are objective. Now, having established, I think, that not only is politics a moral enterprise, and therefore there are right and wrong answers morally speaking, and God cares about that, and he has an opinion about that, he's on the side of the right, and if we then choose the right side, he's on our side. It is probably safe to say that any particular party, their platform, contains policies that are both good and bad in some mixture. So even though there are individual right answers to particular, I should say there are right answers to particular issues, given that any party's platform is an admixture of issues, it probably is the case they don't get them all right in that one party. I don't think any party gets it all right. No individual gets it all right, even when he's trying to. So that's just a a reality. And since this is here in this country not a pure democracy, we don't get to pick and choose by voting on particular issues, generally speaking. Instead, we vote for a candidate who represents an amalgam of positions, some, by the way, we may disagree with, and others we agree with. And if we disagree with them, we think they're wrong. And if wrong, then they are things that God would not support in isolation, but are still part of this larger package. And since we only get to vote for a candidate and not for the issues directly, and in a presidential race, there are only two candidates, for all intents and purposes, I mean, multiple party options aside for the moment, then, follow me here, one candidate or the other will represent on balance, when all the proper weighing of variables like means and ends and moral significance, etc., are all taken into consideration, there will be one candidate of the two who will represent the morally superior position from God's perspective. And then that person becomes the right person to vote for. And that person's party, the right party to align yourself with. So that if God were voting, that is the way that he will cast his vote. In other words, there is nothing unusual at all about saying that God is on the side of one party or the other taken as a whole, which is the only way you can take them. Now, follow my reasoning here. I'm just simply saying we go to politics. Politics is a moral enterprise. That's what it is. It's what it answers the question, what is the right use of what is the appropriate use of power to accomplish the common good? It's a moral question. And all the particular policies that any party confronts or relates to or advances turns out to have moral weight to it. And if moral weight, then there are good policies morally and bad policies morally, all things taken into consideration. And if some policies turn out to be morally bad policies, God is against those and the good policies he's in favor of. And when you line yourself up on the side of this that is actually good for that policy, then you're on God's side and he's on yours. But it turns out that in politics, we're not just dealing with policies in the abstract or individually. We are dealing with parties who represent a package of policies. And so then you have to take the package of policies as a whole, since that's all we get to vote for, the packages. And we have a moral obligation to vote for that package, which on balance is better than the other one. And when we do, if God were voting, he would vote the way we would if we got it right. That's all I'm saying. So if we are Democrat or Republican, we should be able to say, I genuinely believe, I could be mistaken. I'm not claiming omniscience here. But I'm serious about using my political power wisely and well. And when I consider all the options, I genuinely believe that God would vote with me on this one. And if we can't say that, friends, then we should change our votes. This is not arrogance. It's careful, responsible thinking about the nature of politics, morality, and God. So we do, it seems to me, have a moral obligation to vote for one candidate or another. There is a right choice and a wrong choice, or maybe in some cases there is a good choice and a better choice. This is not to say, I'm not saying that one candidate is good and the other evil, though that could be the case. I'm talking, for the most part, not about the candidate proper, but about the policies that candidate represents. So this is just another roundabout way of saying that God is a Democrat, or that he is a Republican, or some other party, in the nuanced sense that I just described. And that brings me to the issue of partisanship, very quickly on this one now. Senator Joe Lieberman said, essentially during the convention, appealing at the Republican convention, though he was an independent/Democrat, former Democrat, now officially independent, though he considers himself in his heart a Democrat. And anyway, in any event, he said, let's get beyond party differences and focus on running the government. In other words, let's get past our differences and try to get things done. And this has a lot of appeal to some people, lots of people, because they're tired of the bickering. And so a word on partisanship, which he is arguing we should get away from. I think that there are two ways one can be partisan. One is a vice, the other is morally obligatory. First, the vice. There is a kind of partisanship that is pure belligerence. And I think when loyalty to one's party is simply loyalty for the sake of loyalty to the party, these are our guys, right or wrong. And that this loyalty is characterized by mean-spiritedness, deception, malicious conflict, then I think partisanship has become corrupted. And I don't think it needs to be that way. I don't think you have to, in fact, I don't think it's even morally sound to say we should never be partisan. Because there is a type of partisanship that seems to me that is necessitated by the accurate observation that all politics is moral. And the idea is that if our goal as public servants is to find God's side, the right choice to the moral questions we face as public servants, our exercise of power, then it seems to me we're obliged to defend those views over and against those who disagree because we're convinced that our views are right and those are wrong. And I don't know how that can be avoided. Because there are worldview considerations that are in play here. It's as if somebody is saying, let's get beyond our squabbling about what's wrong with this machine and let's just fix it. Well, of course, before you can fix something, you have to know specifically what's wrong with it. And before you can know what's wrong with it, you have to know how it's supposed to work to begin with. And that is precisely the difference between different parties. When the parties are operating at their best, they represent different understandings of how the political project works, how the optimum working of the political project has gone afield, and how we can fix it. Just take the two ideas of liberty and equality. Characteristically, conservatives have since championed the side of liberty over equality, and liberals have championed the side of equality over liberty. If you have liberty, full freedom, there's a meritocracy. And in meritocracy, you get rewarded for your merit. But when you get rewarded for your merit, there's going to be inequalities. Those who merit more get more, and those who don't, don't. Some people are uncomfortable with that. And they want the equality, especially the equality in where you end up, not just equality with where you start. And so they value more than liberty and meritocracy, equality and parity. Everybody kind of having the same. Now, these views, and I'm sure you could figure out where I come down on this one, but the point is that whatever your view, this view will dictate certain policies that you think right and good. And if you think right and good, you ought to defend them. And if you defend them as policies for your party, you are of necessity going to be partisan. You cannot avoid that. Nor should you. And here is the simple reason why you shouldn't. Because God does take sides. If you have thought carefully about your views and you think your views of the project and how civilization is supposed to work and what public service means and the role of government in the life of the people for the common good, what that actually looks like, and you can't come up with a conclusion that will dictate certain policies that you think are right, and by golly, if you think they're right and they are, then God's on your side. And if the other party is contrary to that, they're wrong. And their views are contrary to the public good and, taken as a whole, contrary to God. No, I'm not saying in this discussion who's who in this debate in this particular election. I'm just trying to ennoble the notion of partisanship in appropriate ways and to underscore the fact that partisan is justified by the fact that politics is about the proper use of power for the common good, therefore it's a moral enterprise, therefore God cares. He takes sides. And our business should be to get on his side about this, figure out what that is, and then stay there. 1-800-227-5278. I'm Greg Kokel, and this is Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker. Issues right out of the headlines. Issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. The show is Stand to Reason. I was reading something, and I saw the word mind, and so I said it. But it is about the mind well used, hopefully. And I have just given you a piece of mine. I'm looking to hear a piece of your mind here at 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code, dial direct 754-4150. Let's go to all the way to Ohio, and our first caller, Chris. Hello, Chris. Greg Kokel.
Hello.
Nice to talk to you, Chris.
Nice to talk to you, too.
Thank you.
My question is, I was at church today, and this lady brought forth my girlfriend's brother.
Mm-hmm.
He recently got in a car accident, and she said that basically that, you know, Satan was, like, trying to take him out. And I hear lingo like this used all the time in church. Like whenever something bad happens, like all of a sudden goes broke and like Satan's trying to invade their finances or something bad happens. They always think it's the work of Satan. But I mean, is that really, I don't really think that's biblical, but then how would you go about maybe expressing that to someone to maybe change their mind about it?
Okay. Two thoughts. One question is it biblical? And the second one is how do we persuade people with regards to that? And I think it was C.S. Lewis who made a great observation about Satan and spiritual warfare in that sense, the sense that you just described it. I think there are different senses of spiritual warfare, but in this particular sense, this kind of direct demonic engagement Satan or demonic engagement with Christians. Lewis said we either emphasize it too little or we emphasize it too much. Now, I think that a person who is inclined to interpret everything as a demonic attack, if there's a demon under every bush, if Satan is behind everything, I think this person has an unbalanced view of the world. There are actually, according to the scripture, and I think this is in 1 John, but I can't give you the exact reference. You can use your concordance and look it up, Chris. But if you according to scripture, every Christian has three enemies. Those are the world, the flesh, which is himself in a certain sense, and the devil. I think John calls it the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. That would be the flesh and the world that he's identifying there. But we also have our enemy, the devil. Much of our sin, indeed, I suspect most of it, comes from us. That is, that if you read in James chapter 1, it is something about our fallenness that that allows temptation to find a root and give birth to sin. James chapter 1 talks about the process there a little bit. Our biggest enemy is ourselves in that regard. It's almost like there's a nasty little fire going on inside of us, and we have two allies of the fire, the fire of sin, if you want to put it that way. One ally is the world, and the other ally is the devil. So they're both kind of blowing on the coals to get them hotter to create more difficulty for ourselves. I don't think, by and large, they're working with nothing or they're working totally on their own. I think that we have fleshly desires that then are inflamed by temptation and by malicious influence by the world and by the devil. Are you with me so far on this?
Yes, I get you.
Okay, so I think this is a proper balance. Now, if we talk about the devil made me do it all the time, and we act like it's always demons that are doing it, and some people do. And this is the theology of some people. And this, I think, characteristically, though not limited to this group, but characteristically on the kind of the far Pentecostal side, you have a lot of this going on, the word faith teaching and the like. And maybe this is what you've just run into. And I think that's an imbalance. Because the minute you start blaming something else for your troubles, that's something else which you can't control, then you become the victim and you're not responsible anymore.
Right, and also what I was thinking about, I read your article about the comparison you made with Don Quixote and the windmills, and I'm thinking, like, they start praying against something that's really not a threat.
Right, kind of jousting at windmills, right. And if it turns out that the problem is with them and not with a demon, then they're misdirecting their efforts, right. Now, as to the particular question, though, of whether demons can, or the devil, when you say Satan, I think you mean not him personally, but his kind of horde, his army, if you will, can Satan cause car accidents and things like that? I have no good reason to think otherwise. There is no question that from a biblical perspective, Satan and his and demons' demonic activity can cause things in the world. They can cause bad things to happen. They can cause people to be possessed, for example. They can cause evil enterprises. And, if I had more time, I could probably think of a number of scriptural examples of this, but certainly demon possession, where a person's body is controlled by a demon in some measure. If that's in the Gospels, and if that can happen, then I don't see why a demon can't cause other things to happen in the world. And in fact, doesn't the scriptures, the book of Revelation, talk about the demons or Satan waging war against the saints? Now, how would he be doing this? He'd be doing it, it seems to me, indirectly through others that he is having a determinative influence on. In other words, in some sense, his interaction determines the result. And had he not been doing it, this wouldn't have happened. So I could see that, you know, a demon could be involved in the chain of causation of all kinds of bad things that happen to people. Now, it may be that when if this person is going in financial difficulty, it may be she's spending too much, or maybe she's not good at balancing her checkbook, or maybe she's irresponsible in some other way. That certainly is possible. And it is also possible, in my view, that she is kind of under attack, that there is something else going on where disaster befalls her that is part of a larger plan, a demonic plan in the heavenly places that is meant to thwart the purposes of some Christians. Now, by the way, we see this clearly in Ephesians 6, and you're probably aware of that passage, right, Chris? Ephesians 6, just make a note of that. And the last half of Ephesians 6, I believe it is, it talks about spiritual warfare and our spiritual armor.
Right.
That we are to put on the full armor of God so that having done everything, we can stand firm in the evil day. This is verse 10, chapter 6, verse 10, all the way to the end of the chapter. So all of that seems to suggest that there is a kind of armor that we have to protect us from these rather direct attacks from the demonic realm. I think it's entirely possible that in many cases, our own lives, that there are seasons when we, for lack of a better phrase, come under attack. And there's adversity and hardship and difficulty that come into our lives that is specifically engineered by the dark side, if you will, to make our lives miserable, to distrust God, and to turn against Him, to make bad decisions, to sin, all kinds of things.
Right.
And I think that they can be those demonic beings can be very powerful and persuasive in doing so. And I think there have been lots of times in my own life where I've been victimized by that, where I have not been fully aware that there is in a sense, a spiritual dimension to the challenges that I'm facing right now that just seem, when they seem to come from everywhere and nonstop, when you're trying to do something good for God, then you start realizing, hey, maybe this isn't just happening by accident. All right?
All right.
Under attack. So what I'm saying, I guess, in answer to your question is there are really two sides to this issue. We don't want to minimize it. We don't want to maximize it. We want to have a biblical balance.
Okay.
The biblical balance is to understand that there are three enemies we have: the world, the flesh, and the devil. And the one that's the biggest is the flesh, in my view, because that's us. And that's where most of our sin, well, that is where our sins come from, according to James and other passages. They come from us. Jesus says it's inside of a person that comes all of these things, these fornications and murders and all. That comes from the heart of the man. So the biggest problem is our heart. We start blaming it on things around us and demons and stuff like that. Then maybe we're not addressing the real problem. However, sometimes we are not alert to the kind of attack that comes from the outside when we ought to be. So, and this is the Ephesians 6 stuff. So I just encourage. My encouragement is to be wise and circumspect and realize that this can come from both directions. Though, from what you told me about your friend, I suspect maybe she's over-exaggerating a little bit.
All right, because I guess my only hang-up is there's a tendency to be almost borderline just spooky with anything that happens. I guess me and trying to be more, I guess, clear-minded, not be superstitious, to look at a certain Satan sort of causation, I know if they were just getting kind of spooky, but
I think it's hard to tell in any given situation what really is going on.
Right.
I mean, it's like, wait a minute, did that just happen? Was that Satan messing around, or was that my fault? Was that just things? You know, stuff happens.
Right.
You know, in the world, and we're in a fallen world. We live within the contingencies of a broken world, and so I don't think we have to figure all of that out. But I do think we need to be on our guard, knowing that even if something happens kind of out of nowhere, as it were, it still could be something that is used by the other side to cause discouragement.
Okay.
And the enforcer and I were just talking about a mutual friend is going through some very difficult times, and she's being deeply discouraged right now. And I have gone through seasons in my life when I've been deeply, deeply discouraged and haven't seen God's hand working the way I expected Him to work. I think those are the times we are most vulnerable to attacks from the outside, wearing us down and getting us to doubt. And this is where the shield of faith, I think, has to come into play.
Yeah, thanks, Greg.
All right, Chris, I appreciate your call. I think it's an important issue, and it is one of those things that I think we often give the short shrift. Shall we go to the next call here? Time-wise, all right. Let's go to David in Victorville, California. David, I bet it's pretty hot there right now, isn't it?
No, not at all. It's actually really nice.
Oh, really? Okay, today's kind of a hot day in Los Angeles, so I thought out there in the kind of desert it would be hotter, but maybe not.
No. We're working on fall here.
Oh, I got you. A lot of people don't realize, by the way, that much of the desert, if not most of the desert in Los Angeles, I mean in California, except for Death Valley, is actually high desert, 3,000 to 4,000 feet high, and therefore it can get quite cold at night, even in the summer. So, all right, Dave, what's on your mind?
Well, you were mentioning in your opening monologue that essentially that God picks and chooses sides with respect to an election.
I put it a little bit differently, but let's see if the distinction makes any difference for your question. Well, I said that he is on a side, that he holds a view, and the view has to do with moral positions, and if you take the position that God takes on a policy issue, then you are on his side, and given that candidates represent an amalgam of policies, then on balance, one amalgam, that is one platform, is morally superior to the other, and if you have to vote for one or the other, you should vote for the morally superior one, and therefore God, by that sense, would be on the side of the candidate in virtue of the policies they represent.
Okay. That being said, then, if you have two candidates that are pro-choice, or pardon me, pro-abortion, you would be saying then that God, in some fashion, is pro-abortion, because one of those two candidates that's pro-abortion is going to be elected. So then you're suggesting that God somehow has an interest in the outcome of two pro-abortion candidates.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Being elected.
Yes, the last thing you said is true, but the earlier things don't follow. Let me ask
you. Let me.
I know exactly your point that you're making. I'm not confused about the point. I'd like to answer it though,
sure.
Because I get you. Are you married? When you got married, your wife has certain virtues. Is that correct?
Yes.
She's probably listening, so you better say yes, all right?
No, my wife is not listening.
Oh, she's not. Okay, but I mean, that's a fair thing to say. I mean, in fact, your marriage to her was a celebration of those virtues. That's why you made the choice. Is that correct?
Certain virtues, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Well, don't you celebrate all her virtues? Wouldn't that be – okay, well, it's not necessary for my point. But she has vices as well.
Sure. All right.
But does that mean that because you married her in a way of affirming her virtues, that you are at the same time celebrating the vices that came with it?
Well, but see, I understand your point. But see, now we're talking about the creator of the universe. We're
right.
Not talking about another human being. And what you're suggesting then is that God, in somehow, is accepting, or actually, I even want to get further into that, is partially to blame for the evil that's being taken place with respect to the approval of abortion. And
well,
I would wholeheartedly disagree with that.
Yeah, I do disagree with that view too, but that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that, I'll explain it again. And that is that when you have two candidates and you must choose between two candidates, and I was careful to kind of specify this and in the beginning so this was clear, and those candidates have a variety of views, you are to choose the best combination. When you choose the best combination, you are not affirming individual wrong views that they have. What you're doing is you're taking the package that accomplishes the greatest good. Just like when you get married, you are taking the package in light of the virtues and not at the same time affirming as good the vices. Whether it's a human being or the God of the universe doesn't change this equation any bit at all.
Sure, I would disagree with that just simply because this is the there is no evil in God, and so.
That's right. I agree.
So this is the problem that I have with so many people that are pro. You find this among conservative Christians more so, that are so pro-election. Most are distinctly Republican, and that is. Are you suggesting then that God chooses good candidates to put into office and lets Satan put in bad?
Okay, let me put you on hold because I have to go to break and I'll come
sure.
back to you. But you are, I mean, in fairness, I guess, to myself, and maybe it's my fault, but you are deeply confused about my view. So let me come back to you, and I'll try to clarify one more time, and we'll take it from there. Greg Kokel, stand to reason. Don't go away.
Tired of defending your faith with, the Bible says so, does too, or I think it does? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, a tournament of thought in every show, and speaking of which, we'll be speaking on Saturday night at the Centers for Apologetics Research. I say a tournament of thought, and that reminded me of this because I want to give you a piece of my mind coming up this next Saturday night. This group, the Centers for Apologetics Research, is a sensational group that is working right now in Africa. In fact, they want to raise up a generation of apologists in Africa, and that's what this event is going to be about. It's 6:30 until 8 o'clock at the Bowers Museum in Santa Ana. I'm going to give you the phone number in just a moment. You can call for more information, so get a pen or a paper or something to write this down. I'd like to see you there, and I'd like to have you come not only to hear what I have to say about guarding the gospel and what we can learn from 2 Timothy about our enterprise as followers of Christ and his ambassadors and the defenders of the gospel and how that would apply to, say, the impact of the gospel in Africa, indeed awakening Africa to guard the gospel. That's coming up Friday, Saturday night, and I want to extend my invitation to you. Here's the number. 949 is the area code. 496-2000 is the number. 496-2000 in the 949 area code. All right, let's go back to David. And so far, David, I don't know what the problem is. There's been a kind of a massive confusion, and so I'm going to try do my best to clear it up here.
Is that my fault or your fault?
I don't know. I think the listeners are going to have to decide that for themselves.
Yeah,
I mean, I think I'm eminently clear, but apparently, based on what you said, the last thing you asked me was, are you suggesting that God chooses the good candidates and Satan chooses the bad? And my comments had nothing to do with God choosing any candidate whatsoever. Here's the setup. in the election we're facing, we were just talking about the presidential candidates. We have two candidates representing two parties. Mm-hmm. By and large, that's what we're faced with, one or the other. The other guys aren't even in the running. If we sit back and do nothing, one or the other is going to win. Now, I think our moral obligation before God, since this is a moral enterprise politics, and therefore we have a moral obligation to have the greatest impact for good, then our obligation is to choose the candidate that represents the most good in his party platform. Now, I admitted that this means there's probably going to be a mixture of good and bad in the platform, but since my goal is to vote for the better good, when I do vote for the greater good, I am not affirming the goodness of the badness on their platform. I am simply saying, taken as a whole, this person's policies will be better in the moral sense for the country than this other person's policies. Now, if that is in fact the way it is, that one person is morally better than the other, then voting for that person is making the right moral choice. And if I'm making the right moral choice, then I am making the choice that God would have me make in that circumstance. And indeed, if God were in the ballot box, he would mark his ballot the same way that I was marking it. That was my point.
Okay.
And I'm going to let you just give a final word here because I have to move on.
Sure. That being said, though, you're basing morality on not what God considers moral, but you're basing morality on what a human being considers moral. For example...
Wait. We got to stop there because if that's what you think I'm doing, then we've passed each other in the night. I am not basing morality on my decision. Morality is based on God, but it becomes every individual's task to try to figure out what that is. That's all I'm talking about here. Got to go, David. We've talked before. I'm sure we'll talk again. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Frank in San Jacinto. Frank, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hello, Frank. Frank. Earth to Frank. Frank, did I push the wrong button? Let me hold on. I probably did. Let me try it again. He's on three, right? Let me try it again. Frank? You sure he's on three? I'm pushing three here. I hear somebody waiting in the background. Let me just go on hold. Let me try number four. You sure it's not four? No, I guess Frank is gone, huh? Okay, well, I'll come back to Frank later. Let's go to Richard in Anaheim. Richard, welcome to the show. Hi there.
Simple question. If I can, since I go to God directly...
Could you speak a little bit louder, please?
Oh, sure.
Richard, sorry.
Sure. Since I go to God directly, why do I need religion?
Okay, say that again for me, but just give me a little bit more information.
I talk to God every day.
Yes.
Why do I need religion?
Well, religion turns out to be... those statements that describe what your accurate relationship of God entails. So if you say that anybody can talk to God during the day at any time and he listens to them, that is a theological statement, and you have just made a statement of religion. Now, it may be that this is Richard's personal religion, and doesn't represent a world religion, but it's still a statement of religion. What religion turns out to be is an organized set of beliefs about relating to the other world, if you will, the transcendent world. By the way, not all religions involve God. In Buddhism, in classical Buddhism, the issue of God is irrelevant. But all religions... deal with these broader issues of transcendent reality. So, if you're saying to me, well, I can talk to God whenever I want, why do I need religion? My response is, well, you've just described to me religion. I don't see how you can avoid it.
Well, because when I think of religion, I think of, like you said, Buddhism, Islam, Christianity.
Well, those are more formalized religions, right.
Basically, I don't need anything like that. I don't need anyone getting in between me and God. I don't need other people, other books, or anything.
Well, to be fair to the other religions, the characterization of reality that other religions give with regards to God does not itself become something that's getting in the way of you and God. Let's say, Richard, we were friends, all right? And we have a notion of what friendship entails. That friendship entails sharing and communication and trust and shared ideas or something like that, all right? Mm-hmm. Well, it wouldn't make sense to say that friendship is getting in between you and I. Well, friendship is those things I just described that were part of friendship are what makes this is what describes the nature of the relationship that we are having unobstructed, in an unobstructed way. It might tell us how we could know each other better, but it doesn't get in the way. If I wrote you a letter, I don't know, it would make sense to say, well, Greg wrote me a letter, but this letter that Greg wrote communicating something to me about himself is getting in the way of our relationship. No, it's an expression of our relationship. So if God writes a letter to us, that book or whatever doesn't have to get in the way. It is a way that God is communicating to us about himself.
Well, this is how I kind of think about it. Why should I go through Paul when I can bypass Paul and just go to God?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, the question is, if you're assuming something, of course, in all of our conversation, and the assumptions that you've had is that you are, in fact, in touch with God on a daily basis and have this relationship with him. Now, I'm not saying aye or nay to that at this point. I'm just saying that you are making an assumption there. Now, if your assumption is correct, let's go before Paul and go to Jesus for a moment. Because Paul represented Jesus, or at least that was his claim, and Jesus' worldview, and Jesus is more central, I think, to this discussion. If what you say is correct, that you really do have this unobstructed relationship with God in which you talk to him every day, then what Jesus said about God was wrong, and what you say is right, because Jesus didn't have that view of God. So now it becomes a question of who's really right about this. Is Richard in Anaheim correct in the idea that you don't need anything else, that you can have direct access to God just the way you are and everything's just fine? Or whatever other details that you can consider is true about your religious view? Or is someone like Jesus, who doesn't hold that view, is he correct in his view? Because clearly you have competing views.
Correct. We have competing views. We have two human beings making different claims, which, you know,
well, they can't both be true because they're contradictory.
Right, which I can't impose on anyone else, and I don't try to. I don't try to force my view on anybody.
Well, I don't try to force my view either. I think my view is true, and I'll try to persuade people, but I'm not forcing it. I don't know if that language is helpful.
Well,
if you think your view is true and this matters, why wouldn't you try to persuade somebody?
Because
in fact, it seemed to me you called me for that purpose, didn't you, Richard?
Yeah, but you're missing the point. I don't go around knocking on doors.
No, you called me up in this case, but
yeah.
Are you saying that calling a radio show to persuade somebody they're wrong is not is okay, but knocking on somebody's door is
not? Oh, definitely, because I asked a question. I wanted to know your opinion.
Uh-huh.
And basically, I don't threaten anyone with any kind of external threat.
I'm not threatening people, but when I talk about, say, things like hell, that's not a threat. That is an acknowledgement of what I think the consequence is going to be if people don't receive the pardon that's offered them by their sovereign. It's not a threat.
This is exactly what I avoid. I bypass all this entirely.
I understand.
To deal with this stuff.
Richard, I understand why, because you don't believe in that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You don't believe there is a threat, therefore you'd not warn anybody.
And it goes to my question. I guess I've answered my own question. I really don't need any book or any anything.
Well, Richard, to be fair to you, to be intellectually honest, you haven't answered anything. All you've done is reasserted your own religious view. The real question between us is whose religious view is the accurate one. I mean, you put your finger on that a few moments ago, and I think you're right. You haven't answered your question. You just restated your view. You don't need anybody. But that's exactly the question. Jesus didn't believe that. None of the biblical writers believed that because they thought there really was a God who cared about his people and there was a right way to approach him and a wrong way. It wasn't any old God would do. Pardon me?
Good for them. I wonder why God would just appear to some primitive people 2,000 years ago and leave everyone else out of it.
Well, I don't. Yeah, I don't I'm not going to try to answer the mind of God right now, but the real question is not whether why he would do that, but whether your view of God is a correct one or marginally correct or possibly correct or slightly correct or not. It doesn't seem to me like you've engaged that issue at all. You just don't like the idea that that there might be organized religion that would impose some kind of demands on you, and so you've just simply rejected it and decided to go straight to God. That's your liberty, and I can't stop you, but there may be consequences for that choice if you're mistaken.
I don't think so. I don't fear that at all.
Why would you think so?
Oh, I'm not going to listen to another human being tell me about God when I have my own scenario where I deal with God directly.
It's odd because I think you called because you expected other people to listen to your view, which I think is just fine. But that's up to you. Okay, thank you for the call, and I appreciate it, Richard. We've got another hour ahead of us here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us. I'll talk to you in a moment.
Listen, where do you get this nonsense?
Stand to Reason.
All right, hour number two here on Stand to Reason, 1-800-227-5278. This, of course, is the place to get a well-informed mind. If you're in the Orange County area code 714, you can dial direct 754-4150. I like to say this is the place for straightforward, no frills, nothing buttery, real, believable Christianity. I started out the show last hour. If you missed it, you need to go to our website at str.org and download the podcast, because I started out the hour talking about two issues that relate to the election. I'm not going to go back over this, but I just want to remind you if you just tuned in. And they are broader issues. They are meta issues. I'm not campaigning for one side or the other here. I'm trying to clarify an idea. And that idea is whether or not God takes sides and whether or not we should be partisan or not, in a certain sense of the word. I weighed in yes on both of those, and I spent some time giving my reasons. In fact, God does take sides. God does have an opinion about who is the right person to vote for. I'm not saying what that opinion is. I'm just saying in principle, and I gave the reasons why, and that we should figure out what that is, and then we should do that. And if we are doing that, we are then casting our vote for a particular party platform that entails moral positions of necessity, because all politics is moral. And therefore, not only is God, if God were voting, he'd be voting for a certain candidate, but he'd be voting for that party platform taken as a whole, even though, just like you and I, he may not agree with particulars in the platform taken as a whole, it is a better, morally speaking, platform than the other party. And therefore, it is not accurate to say God is not a Republican and he is not a Democrat, at least in one sense. He could be a Democrat or a Republican in the same sense that many of you are, that is, you are casting your vote with a side and by and large are promoting a side that you think represents the greater good for this country, even if you disagree with particulars. And consequently, partisanship then is morally required. If what we mean by partisanship is not just a kind of empty bickering that's for our side and that turns out to be senseless, but in fact it is a commitment to the good based on what we understand is right and based on how we understand the world to be and the proper and appropriate role of government in that world. And sometimes we get those things wrong. I mean, even well-meaning people get the wrong answer. So I don't think people who get it wrong are evil. I think sometimes we end up on the wrong – I mean, are necessarily evil, okay? Sometimes they are. But I think there are a number of reasons we end up on the wrong side of political decisions and therefore the wrong side of God on an issue. Sometimes we get our facts wrong. Maybe we haven't been looking hard enough or close enough. Maybe someone we trust to give us the facts, like the media, has either not given us the facts or have reported the facts in a way that gives the opposite impression of what the facts actually are, the broader picture, the truth of the matter. And we've seen a lot of examples of that in the last couple of weeks. Sometimes we have a wrong view of what the public good is because we lack wisdom or experience or good judgment. And so we make the wrong choice. That's why a lot of young people make the wrong choice. They just don't have the stuff. They don't have the experience. I'm actually against the 18-year-old vote. There's too much wisdom to be gained from 18 to 21 that makes a difference. That's a different issue, however. But sometimes we make bad decisions because we just don't have the experience or wisdom. And sometimes we get on the wrong side because we have the wrong view of the world. And all of these could be reasons we could be wrong and not on God's side, even though we don't realize it, which is why it's important to be thoughtful about our political positions and be good, well, morally and properly morally informed to bring our morality to the table, our properly informed morality, so we can look carefully at these different things that are on the table and not just respond or react because we liked the speech. Or, boy, doesn't he sound great? Or isn't her hair nice? And she's got a great smile. And he's got a winning way about him. These things are irrelevant to the issues. Unfortunately, most people don't get that anymore just by looking at the way polls move. But our obligation as thoughtful people and people who care about what God thinks is to weigh the issues in that sense and not in the other. That is, weigh it according to sound morality and proper moral considerations. Okay, it was just a quick repetition of what I did for the first hour. If you'd like more of that, go back and get the podcast. It's all there. Let's go to Frank because he's been waiting for a while. We missed him a while back. Frank, are you there? Frank.
Yes, I'm here.
Frank, welcome to Stand to Reason. I'm glad you stayed with us.
Yeah, thank you very much for all you do. I love your broadcast.
Thank you, Frank.
I'll say very little about politics after your fiasco with the second caller.
Okay.
I understand what you're saying, and I hear what you're saying. I used to think that, too, that God would certainly be supportive of one side more than the other.
Mm-hmm.
But I've changed my opinion on that. I believe that after all the foolishness I've heard from them, it's more like belongs in the devil's domain, and we need to wear a lot of that stuff like a loose blanket, like we have to do with a lot of other things that's going on in the world.
Are you saying that politics belongs in the devil's domain? Is that what you mean, and we
yes.
should just keep our hands out of it?
I don't think we have. No, I don't mean we have to keep our hands out of it. We need to vote. We need to support what we believe to be the best, as you've been describing. But I do believe that most of it belongs in the devil's domain when I listen to all the foolishness.
Yes, well, you're right about that. I mean, there's a fair observation there, Frank.
Okay, what I called for, really, and I've been wanting to call for a long time to ask this question.
Okay.
And I haven't felt adequate enough, so as you'll see what I mean by adequate, I can't quote chapter and verse.
Mm-hmm.
But for a long time, when I listen to sermons or when I read a lot of publications. I read the Bible, too, but sometimes the publications explain it better than me reading the Bible.
No, I understand entirely. That's what keeps people like me in business, and pastors, too. I mean, it's our job to try to help people understand what the text says.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I often read about God will gather all his people, that's the Jews or Hebrews, whichever you wish to call them, or Israelites. I call them the Hebrews because they are mostly Jews that are there now, but there's quite a few of the other tribes there, too.
Okay.
But he says he will gather them from the four winds, and every last one of them, it's almost as though they will all have a second chance, no matter what they've done. To be saved as a nation, because the Hebrew is saved as a nation rather than an individual, if I read that correctly.
Yeah, I don't think that's quite accurate, but go ahead and I'll respond.
Well, no, I've almost said as much as I need to say. I'm wanting your comment.
All right. The phrase that you used a few moments ago is that you said it's as if all the Jews will get a second chance no matter what they've done.
Yes.
Now, as far as I can tell from reading the scripture, regardless of one's ethnic or religious background, nobody gets a second chance. Everybody gets one chance, and that chance is used up once they die. It is appointed to men to die once, and then comes the judgment. So whatever Jews are on the earth at this point, and any other person for that matter, they all have the same first chance. Once they die, that chance is used up, and that's it. There's no other chance after that.
Yes, I know that for the Christian.
Yeah, so there's no, in one sense, there's no difference between Jews and Gentiles in that regard. Everybody gets the same, in a sense, chance. We get one shot at it. We don't get, you know, overs, in a sense.
Right.
So, but I think maybe more to the point of the question is, what is the role of Israel? And here now we're talking about the nation as opposed to individuals. And I think in this regard, we can talk about the nation of Israel much like we talk about America. America is a nation. Now, we understand that no nation is a nation without being a nation of individuals. But there is a sense in, so it's individuals that make up a nation, but there is a sense in which we can talk about the nation as a whole, and the nation has endured or perdured, it has continued as itself as the years have gone on, even when individuals are born and die and born and die. In fact, the nation of America today is a totally different nation of individuals than it was 150 years ago, but it is still the same America in a certain kind of sense.
Right.
And so that's the way I think we should be looking at Israel. God has made long-term commitments to the nation of Israel, which nation, I think, he has not abandoned with regard to his long-term plans, but he has plans for them and will gather them together and bring them, for example, to the land, which he did, I think, began doing in 1947 and continues to do to this day. Now, we know that when we talk about Israel now, we are talking about the same country, in a sense, the peoples that God has a covenant with that he did 2,000 or 4,000 years ago, even though the individuals in that group are different individuals. And this is the sense, I think, that God has made promises. He's made promises to the family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that family is rather large now, and we don't know who they all are because the tribes have been scattered, but I think God does, and that I think there's going to be a time when God will fulfill his purposes to national Israel in a way that's different than his purposes for the church. And so theologically, I'm making a distinction between the two in the sense that I'm talking about.
Yes, I believe that.
The groups. Yeah. But I am not saying that any individual Jewish person is going to receive favoritism with regards to the judgment question about their own lives simply because he's Jewish. Each person stands on his own before God in that regard, and just as there is no Jew nor Greek nor slave nor free nor male and female in the issue of judgment, they all stand individually before the throne of God for judgment on their own lives. Then with regards to the opportunity for salvation, there is no Jew nor Greek nor slave nor free nor male nor female, but all are one in Christ.
But it says they are blinded to our benefit.
Yes, that's in Romans.
And in the Old Testament. No, well, Romans, sorry, it's not in the Old Testament.
Yeah, well, Paul is talking about that the Jews have as a nation, not all. He points out, and he makes a point of stating that he himself is an exception to this, because he is a Jew who is a believer, and the first century church began with virtually all Jews until 15 or 20 years later when they started to expand into the Gentile areas. And even then, the first followers of Jesus as Messiah were themselves ethnic Jews. So Paul says there are Jews, ethnic Jews, that do believe that Jesus is the Messiah, but the nation taken as a whole is in rebellion. Just like in the Old Testament times, you had a believing remnant, even when the rest of the country was falling into idolatry. So a similar thing is happening now, where you've got this remnant. So what the New Testament is talking about in the book of Romans there is that there will, right now the emphasis more is on Gentiles that are coming to the Messiah that is for all peoples, But there is going to be a time when that emphasis will shift and the fullness of the Gentiles will come in, and then there'll be a greater response characteristically from those who are within the nation of the Jews, as it were, and those individuals will still have to come to the Jesus as Messiah in order to get their individual redemption. But since it's corporately going to be the nation that does so, characteristically most of the Jews, that is going to represent, I think, a revival for national Israel, which now would be characteristically responding to God and their Messiah rather than rejecting them. And I think this is going to be on the right there at the threshold of a kingdom era where certain promises of God to Israel that are political in nature will be fulfilled in this earth. How that all gets cashed out in precise terms, I think, is hard to say. But what I've tried to do is really make this distinction between Israel and the Gentiles and the church in a way that makes sense, that with regards to salvation and the new covenant, there is no distinction because we all come to God through his Messiah in the same way by individual faith. But there are other covenants like Palestinian covenant and particular elements of the Abrahamic covenant and the Davidic covenant that I think apply to the nation of Israel as a nation. Not to give them a second chance individually, everybody has the same single chance, but to fulfill his good purpose towards this peoples that he has promised himself to. Frank, does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. I followed what you said.
Does that help answer that question?
Yes, it does.
All right.
And before you go, or before I go, I was 30 years in Africa, Greg, and I thought I might call into that number you gave if I could be of any use to it.
Yes, thank you. Let me give you the number again.
I put it down here, 949-496-2000.
That's right. That's CIFAR, the Center for Apologetic Research, where I will be speaking on Saturday night next, on September 27th, down in Santa Ana at the Bowers Museum there, 6:30 to 8.
I'm a bit far away there for an old man. Yes.
Oh, no, but, you know, I'm so glad you called. Now, you said you spent a lot of time in Africa, but you do not sound like you're from Africa originally.
No,
is that Scottish?
No, I'm Irish. But
oh, I'm sorry. I guess that's probably
no problem.
No problem. Well, you know, to a Yank like me, you guys all sound alike, you know.
Gaelic crowd.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I appreciate the call. I think we just lost you there by accident. I don't know what happened, but, Frank, just so you know, I didn't do that. But I'm so glad to have talked to you, and I hope that answer helped. Okay, to a break now, just a little bit early, and then we'll come back to to Leland in Ontario. And, God, we got a whole list of callers here. I'll be jumping through them quickly when we return on Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Greg Kokel giving you something worth thinking about every weekend here on Stand to Reason. And I like to say we don't just teach you what to think, but how to think as well. We got a lot of people on the line. I want to get to them all before the end of our show here at the top of the hour. So let's go to let's go to Leland here in Ontario, California. Leland, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg.
Hi there.
I called to see if you knew anything about an organization called the International House of Prayer.
Not heard of it. Sounds like a restaurant.
Yeah, no, they actually go by that acronym too, as IHOP.
No kidding.
No. It was started, I guess, some years ago in Kansas City by a guy named Mike Bickle.
Sound familiar, but I will tell you that there have some spiritual movements that have come out of Kansas City that have not been good. So-called Kansas City Prophets. Does this have anything?
He came from that. He came from that.
Uh-huh.
And he started a – well, there's an organization here in Rancho Cucamonga that – it's not directly affiliated with them, but they're trying to be like them. And basically their whole idea is that in Kansas City for several years now, they've basically had 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, continuous music and worship and prayer and fasting going on at their center.
Well, it's hard to argue with that. I mean, in fact, there was actually a prayer meeting, I don't know if you knew this, that went on for over 100 years. This was the Moravians.
Oh, I was just reading about that.
And that was 17th century, I think, and 16th century. And they had an unbelievable missionary impact for their size and for the technology of the time. I mean, these are people that committed themselves to spread the gospel around the earth and took ships and went to bizarre places and died by the scores in the process, but had a tremendous impact nonetheless, the Moravians. So I'm all for extended prayer and fasting.
Now, as far as that goes, they actually, the Refuge House of Prayer that's here in Rancho Cucamonga, I was reading some of their literature, and they cited them, although there's some things that I kind of worry about when I read they're saying that basically they're doing this to recreate sort of like the Tabernacle of David. The reason they're doing that is because they don't believe, what they put it, Jesus is not coming back to a prayerless church, but rather to one enjoying mature bridal partnership with him in intercession for the great harvest.
Yeah, I think that's a bunch of I should back up here. Let me be more charitable. I think that's false, okay? Jesus made it clear that when he comes back, he is going to be coming back. There is nothing that I know of in the New Testament that it relates to prayer that is the thing that brings Jesus back. In fact, what? Jesus said, when I return, will I found faith on the earth? Just in the I think this is Luke, 19 or something. You know, he's talking about the unrighteous judge and people persevering in prayer. And, of course, we are to persevere in prayer, But he makes a comment about whether or not there people will be persevering in prayer when he returns. So it seems to me it suggests that it's possible that he will return even though people are not persevering in prayer, or even if the servants are not watching when their master returns. This is another way of speaking Jesus used. He also, Paul seems to indicate that Jesus will return when the fullness of Gentiles comes in or something like that. In other words, I don't know any biblical reason to think that Jesus won't return because people aren't praying enough.
What bothers me is that's just part of their whole attitude of, you know, enabling the Holy Spirit. That they're really into like the gifts, healing, and really, really fasting. I have a dear friend that goes back to the church I walked into in 1991 when I first moved here to California and started becoming a Christian, is on her way down to San Diego now, engaged in a 40-day fast. Thank goodness she's not going to be on pure water, but that was the original goal.
I
read the book they had in their library, or their bookstore, by a guy named Mahesh Chavda, and he advocates the back cover of his book advocated fasting as a way of learning to unleash the power of the Holy Spirit in you, that kind of thing.
Yeah, And
by the way, there are people that spend their time down there person I mentioned already in another one from
Leland, let me jump in. Let me just
they
jump
don't even
in
work, Greg. They live by raising money.
Right. Well, I don't let me just say this. I don't know anything about the International Church of Prayer, the IHOP, in that sense. I am suspicious based on some of the theological things that you told me, though I think that the notion of praying a lot and in a dedicated fashion and fasting and praying as described in the New Testament is a spiritual virtue in principle. It doesn't mean that there can't be people who use that inappropriately and try to use it to force God in some way, or they have odd theology associated with it. I don't know much about the Moravians, but I do know about their sacrificial efforts at missionary work, and so their prayer supported that work, which showed itself in powerful results. But it can be that you have groups that are committed to things that are good, like prayer and fasting, but have an aberrant theology that distorts then the entire enterprise. And my suspicion, without finding out more about this particular group, is that these people are something along that line.
Yeah,
so I don't, you know, I wish I could be more encouraging about this, but my experience when I find people that fall into things like this, these groups always seem to get what I would say biblically weird. They just go off into weird directions with unusual doctrines and crazy ideas, and it doesn't turn out to help a lot of things. It just turns out to be a flash in the pan. The Moravians, by contrast, had a remarkable impact for hundreds of years. But I don't see the same thing happening with these groups. I could be mistaken. Maybe I'm isolated from them and don't know. But and that could be why I'm not seeing. But from what you've told me of the theology, I think it's already really weird. Now, you can have weird theology and still pray effectively. But sometimes there's a critical mass where the theology begins to take over and then ruin the entire enterprise. Leland, got to go. I thank you for that call. Let's go to New York. And Oliver, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, you're welcome. Do you go by Ollie or Oliver or what?
Yeah, I often do.
Okay, Ollie, what's up?
I was flipping through the stations and I heard you talking about the subject and I thought what a great thing to be asking and I appreciate your raising these issues.
Good. Is that the partisanship? Was that the question of partisanship? Is that the one you're referring to or something else?
Yeah, and more specifically, actually, does God take sides?
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know, it was definitely a question that sparked my interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a bit of a trick question. And it's, I think it's really, really important. When I sat with that and I thought in my heart of why that question touched me so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, why was something with that sitting with me in sort of a way that was wasn't feeling good.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason when I thought about it deeply is I thought God just, he doesn't take sides. What God does is God brings sides together. And that's what God does. And I think that in my heart of hearts is that when people present God as something that is divisive, that's a dangerous thing.
Okay, so let's just say you have a point of view.
Yeah,
and
no,
wait, let me just.
That's the only thing I really wanted to say, and I think that it's a good thing. It's a good question to ask, but I think it's a good thing to look at the overall picture and not just to bring it down to it to try and trivialize it.
Oh no, if you thought that I was trivializing anything, then you misunderstood my point, and I can take responsibility for that. But that certainly wasn't what I was after. In fact, it was quite the opposite, because the issues are not trivial at all. It's important for us to think carefully about this. Were you suggesting you didn't want to talk about this? You just wanted to weigh in and hang on?
That's all I really wanted to say.
Okay.
I just wanted to say that's, you know,
okay, because
that's what I truly believe, and I think that over anything, that is the most important thing that people should take away. Is that,
okay,
that,
okay,
my opinion anyway.
No,
that's just my opinion.
Okay, fair enough. So I have more. I have some things I want to say about that. You can stay on the line and talk with me about it, or else we can, you know, bid a cordial adieu, and then I'll talk about it. And you can listen on the radio. What would you like to do?
Sure, I'll listen to what you have to say about it. I'm always into it.
Okay, what you suggested to me just a few moments ago is you said instead of the view that God takes sides, you said that God wants to bring sides together. Did I get that right?
God wants people to get along and his children to get along and love each other.
Okay, now let's just say for the sake of discussion that you are promoting people getting along and loving each other, which it sounds like you're doing. And I am promoting.
God does that. I think God.
No. I'm just taking
in His path. That's just my people sharing.
Oliver, wait. You don't have to be so careful with this. Is just my opinion. I know it's your opinion. You've stated it. I'm just thinking about what it is you said. You've offered a thought, and you think it's the case that what God wants is He wants people to get along and love each other. All right? He doesn't take sides. Now, let's just say, did I represent your view correctly just there in that summary?
Sure.
Okay, good.
Sure.
Now, let's just say, though I know you're not saying this about me and this isn't my view, but let's just say for the sake of discussion that I believe that we should fight each other and not get along. So we have opposite points of view.
Okay.
Which side does God agree with in that discussion?
That's exactly my point.
So he
is that I don't think that he takes the side.
No, but you just told me God wants us to get along. That's the side that God wants us to get along, and that's the point that you're promoting. So you're saying the very thing that
the side that I'm promoting is the side of the God is the for lack of a better term, in this example that you've given me, God is the almighty arbitrator, the person who holds out his hands to both sides and understands both sides.
Yes.
And has the skill, the love, the compassion,
yes,
and the ability,
uh-huh,
to enable both people to understand.
But let's just say I don't want it. But I don't. Let's just say that I don't want to understand. I want to fight. I want to make misery. So God's view about me is what? That I'm wrong or mistaken, or that I just need to be understood?
Well, maybe you do. Maybe you just need to be understood.
Well, I think God understands me entirely. He understands that I'm vicious and divisive and angry and self-centered. So, does He want me to be that way? From what you said, He doesn't want me to be that way. That's your conviction, right?
I'm not going to place a judgment on you, but I will say that God does love you. And I will do whatever in any kind of adversarial situation. I know that, you can go down the line of for sure, you get pushed up against all the good questions that you ask on your show, where you're really pushed to the edge and you're asked to decide, it's what you're asking me to decide. But I'm just saying, in those moments of weakness, like you were talking about earlier, in those moments of weakness when you are truly tested, those are the moments, and I think to try and bring the conversation to those moments when I would rather talk about how God likes to bring us together and try and commune on that level.
Gotcha. I let you talk there, Oliver. Let me just have the last word on this one, if I could, and then I'm going to thank you for your call here in advance because we're going to move on in just a moment. It seems to me eminently clear that from what you said, you believe that God has a point of view, that He has a side, if you will, in a moral issue, and you've described what that is. And if you line up with His point of view, then your point of view matches His point of view. You're on His side, He's on your side. Every time we got to that particular juncture when I questioned you, though, you begged off. So I'm not sure what you mean anymore if you don't really mean that what God wants to do is to bring people together, and if I don't want to bring people together, then I'm not on God's side on this one. This, to me, is not that difficult. And if you want to bring people together, then you are on God's side on this issue. Point being, you can't avoid the claim that God doesn't take sides. It turns out that such a claim is self-refuting, because you would hold that God doesn't take sides, and that's your side, and so at least He's taking your side on that particular point. Anyway, it's been fun talking to you, Oliver. I thank you for the call, and I'm glad you're listening from New York. Maybe you're on the road right now, but thanks. We're going to move on to another caller here in Redondo Beach, California, and that would be Doreen. Welcome to the show, Doreen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have to start by saying that I have your CDs, Tactics in Defending the Faith.
Good.
Listen to them diligently.
Good.
I think it's so important to be able to logically, defend what
mm-hmm.
we believe, and that it's not just this blind leap of faith.
Mm-hmm.
So so I've spent the last year really trying to bone up on my apologetics.
Good for you. And by the way, did you know at the beginning of the year, Zondervan is publishing a book called Tactics? That same material expanded into book form. They'll be available.
Oh, awesome. Okay,
yeah, so that'll
great.
Come in the first of the year, January, first week, I guess.
Ah, terrific.
The latest
okay.
word they have.
So what I did do is I put the CDs on my iPod, and then I
good
stuck
for you.
I stuck the CDs in my church library on kind of permanent loan.
Uh-huh. Okay, so. Good for you. And, that, you know, that iPod thing is the way to do it. Is I learn things sometimes by listening to it over and over until it really sinks in, and I think you're doing it right.
Well, and I think I probably could have used it better because, well, so, you know, my 10-year-old daughter has, you know, a girlfriend whose mother is an atheist just asking her how to become a Christian, and she leads her in the sinner's prayer. And here mm-hmm. I have this opportunity to witness to somebody on an airplane, and I fumbled at the goal line.
Well, look at two things. You know, God knows who to send who to, all right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, he sent the right person to your daughter at her level, and she sent the right person to you.
Yeah.
Second thing is, as I fumble not only at the goal line, I sometimes get hit for a loss. So you're in
yeah.
good company there.
Well, and I probably got hit for a loss too. So what happened was, and I kind of wanted to just kick it around with you quickly, how you would have answered this. I happened to be reading Hank Hanegraaff's Bible Answer book, one
mm-hmm.
of those. And the guy sitting next to me on the plane said, oh, what are you reading? You know, and we got in this discussion.
Oh, what a question, huh?
Yeah.
I'm glad you asked. Huh?
I know. So, you know, and I just thought, well, cool. God's given me this opportunity to use what I've learned. And so, you know, I was talking to him a little about it, and he goes into how his brother is a Christian philosopher and how, you know, he thinks that that's kind of silly. And, we kind of got into this whole conversation mm-hmm. about how truth is relative. And I said, I kind of said, well, then, you know, because Hitler's truth was relative to him, we still know that the truth is it's horrible to kill 6 million Jews. And he said, yeah, he says, but there's this this Indian tribe, this Eskimo Inuit tribe in Alaska or whatever, that it's part of their culture
mm-hmm.
to for an overnight guest to give the overnight guest their wife
mm-hmm.
for the evening. And when they first sent missionaries in, their missionaries were being put to death because they considered it an insult if these missionaries refused this offer of hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, well, so in this culture, their truth is absolutely that there's nothing wrong with this.
Mm-hmm.
And for us to come in and say, well, you can't do that. And I just didn't know how to answer him. I thought, well,
okay.
That's
yeah. Oh, no, this is a great conversation. First of all, my hat's off to you, Doreen, for engaging this gentleman on the plane and having a conversation like this with him. The book I mentioned on tactics is coming out in January, but I have another book that came out 10 years ago, one I wrote with Frank Beckwith called Relativism,
mm-hmm.
Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. And
yes.
That's where I talk about some of these details. But let me give you a quick kind of thumbnail sketch here. For one, the man is using the word truth in an odd way. It is the way a lot of people use it nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that was their truth, quote unquote truth, and we have our truth. And so all he is doing in this case is looking at different people that have different cultures that have competing ideas about what is right and wrong.
Okay.
So we don't share our wives with guests. They do. They kill people who don't receive the gift. We don't. We think that's wrong. All he has done is identify two different points of view. He has not established that none of those views is actually accurate. See, the relativist is saying there is no perspective that is right or wrong. There are just different perspectives.
Okay.
What he did is he was trying to prove to you that there is no right and wrong simply by pointing out there were different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
But just looking at the fact that two people disagree on things doesn't prove that nobody's right on it.
Right.
And that's the mistake he's making. It's actually a logical error. And so if I were in a situation, I don't know, maybe I went a little too quickly there, but let's look at it this way. Let's just pretend that you believe that the earth is round and I think it's flat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we have a difference of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So would it be fair for me to say there is no earth to have a shape because we differ on the shape of it? The Earth doesn't exist because you think it's one shape and I think it's another shape.
Right. That's a totally illogical conclusion.
Yes. So then why would we say, well, he thinks one thing is right and wrong, you think a different thing is right and wrong, therefore there is no right and wrong.
Right.
It's a complete non sequitur.
I see.
So I think probably what I would have done in that situation is when he says that the truth is relative, I would want to ask him, well, what does he mean by that? And maybe you use that question. I'd want him to cash this out, that well, I mean that different people have different views of truth. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then you say, oh, well, that's not truth that's relative. All that means is that people have different opinions.
Right.
That doesn't tell you who's right and who's wrong.
Yeah, because I've heard it described before, like, you know, everyone, it's not possible for everybody to be right, but it is possible for everybody to be wrong.
Sure, yeah, and it's not possible for everybody to be right if they have contradictory claims on things.
Right.
If we all believe the same thing, it's possible for all of us to be right. But when you have people say that abortion is right and abortion is wrong, mm-hmm. Let me put it in a different term, abortion is immoral or it's not immoral. Well, there's no other choices there. It's right. One or the other.
Right.
Now, just because one person thinks it one way and another person thinks it's another way doesn't mean there is no answer. There's got to be an answer. It's either A or non-A. You know, it's one or the other. Either abortion is non-moral or it is immoral.
Well, and I think what he would have said in this case is giving your wife to somebody is perfectly moral in one culture, but it's not moral in another culture.
No, of course. I agree that what we mean by that is those people think it's moral. But my question then to him is it actually morally right in the big picture?
Mm-hmm.
Was it right for them to give the wives and kill the missionaries for not taking their wives? Was that right?
Yeah.
Now, he says, well, it's right for me. And I'm talking, yes, I understand. When you say it's right for you, you mean that you wouldn't do it or you think that it was a mistake for them to do it?
Mm.
See, there's no way out of this for him, but I realize how people can talk in circles on these things because of the way they've been socialized.
Right.
It's either right or it's either it's morally acceptable or it's not. Now, if it's not morally acceptable, it doesn't matter which culture does it, it's still a mistake. If it is morally acceptable, it doesn't matter which culture does it, it's still okay.
Right.
In the big picture.
Right.
That's the question. Yeah. But some people are so thoroughly relativized, it's very difficult to kind of shake them out of that. Sounds to me like you did fine, Doreen.
Well, you know, and it's fun. The thing that God's really given me a lot of confidence about is that there's nothing I'm going to say or do that's going to derail God's plan for somebody else's salvation.
Mm-hmm.
And by knowing that, by internalizing that knowledge, it gives me so much freedom just to play and have God teach me and refine me. And I'm not going to mess it up. I can't get it wrong and, like, ruin somebody's chance.
Yeah,
in the
ultimate sense, you're right. You know, we want to get better. Sometimes we do make stumbles. Sometimes we just do as well as we can, and it's not good enough, and that's okay. But this is why we want to be alert to the process so that we can try to improve on that. And, of course, that's the whole idea about tactics. So I'm proud of you, Doreen.
Well, thank you very much.
Keep up the good work.
All right, thanks so much.
Okay, back with more of your calls in just a moment on Stand to Reason.
Tired of defending your faith with "the Bible says so," "does too," or "I think it does"? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kogel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. And these three self-directed studies will cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
There's a kind of hush all over the world. Tonight, all over the world, you can hear the sounds of lovers in love.
The show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm Greg Kokel, your host, with you every Sunday from 3 to 5. If you're listening on podcast and want to call the show in live, this is Los Angeles, and you can do the math with the numbers and be part of our show at 1-800-227-5278. However, our lines are full for the rest of the show, so you don't need to call in. I'm quickly going to our callers who are here so we can move through them. And in Chicago, Stan. Hello, Stan.
Hey, Greg, thanks for having me on your show. I listened to you, but you came to Chicago about a year ago to Christ Community Church, and I've enjoyed listening to your podcast since then.
Thanks. I'm so glad to hear that. In fact, I get there once or maybe once every 2 or 3 years. I'd love to go to Chicago more often because that's where I grew up, but I'm glad that we were able to connect when I was there last time.
Hey, my situation here is my wife that I'm married to now, we both were married before, and those two spouses passed away.
Uh-huh.
And she stays in real close contact with her in-laws from that marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a brother-in-law and a sister-in-law who live out in California, and they are going to get married in a same-sex marriage.
Both of them to like a dual same-sex marriage, the brother to a man and the sister, or the brother-in-law to a man and the sister-in-law to a woman?
That's correct.
Wow. I'm just surprised. That's in a sense, it seems kind of odd, but in the sense of being coincidental, but go ahead. Okay,
well,
now I got
brother,
it.
They're brother and sister, so
yes.
That's why they're doing that. Both of the women have been artificially inseminated by both of the men, so there's two kids involved. So,
no kidding.
Yeah.
So let's just say there is a brother and sister. Both are homosexual, and the sister's partner has been inseminated by the sister's brother.
That's correct.
And the sister's brother's partner, the guy, has inseminated the sister.
That's correct.
All right. I know this sounds really judgmental, but that seems creepy. It just seems creepy to me. Neither here nor there with regards to your question, but I'm kind of going, oh, gosh, what next?
Well, you know, they're really great people, and,
sure.
And the two kids are great kids, and, you know.
And it's not anything against the children. You wonder when it's going to stop getting so bizarre. You just wonder what's next, and that just seems creepy to me. But anyway, on to other issues. That wasn't the reason you called.
Well, I have three questions, and my wife and I are in two different places about whether or not we should go. I feel like that as Christians, we need to make a stand and say, hey, we don't approve of this.
Mm-hmm.
Turned up by us attending the wedding, that we are saying, hey, we approve and this is okay.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, and I have not really conveyed either way to anybody on that side
mm-hmm.
of me what my feelings are, but
yeah.
She has told me, she has told them that they do not approve of, that we do not approve of this lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, from your personal standpoint, and I guess the person who answered the phone when I called said you were in a similar situation, should we as Christians attend the wedding and...
attend the ceremony.
Attend the ceremony, yeah. Yeah, that's kind of weird saying
mm-hmm.
that, but...
Right, right.
I feel like that we shouldn't, and... another question I have is, when they come to stay at our house, the couple, you know, the two women or the two men,
mm-hmm.
should we allow them to sleep together
mm-hmm.
in our house?
Mm-hmm.
And we have allowed them to do that in the past, but
mm-hmm.
kind of got to thinking about that.
Yeah. Okay, let me respond to that. And I want to start by saying that this is kind of an area I don't go into without a little fear and trembling, because it's difficult. And I think I could see the concerns on both sides. There is a deep desire, obviously, as followers of Christ, to be honorable to him in the way you respond to the situation, and also to be sensitive to the people and be consistent as Christians that you are not inappropriately judgmental of non-believers.
Right.
Okay?
I don't want to do that to them.
And I've modified my view a little bit over the years, not that because I've had – we actually haven't had this same circumstance in our family, but we've had to navigate through this issue of a same-sex relationship, and others on our staff have had closer concerns here. So I've had to work with this a little bit. I asked the question, what is a wedding with regards to the public event? Not what is marriage and the meaning of marriage as a core thing, but what is a wedding? And a wedding is a celebration of the relationship in which people who are friends and family gather together to celebrate and give blessing to the relationship that is being formally initiated at that event. And so I ask myself, can I celebrate and give blessing to that relationship? And the answer to that is clearly no, and I think you and your wife are both aware of that, okay?
Right.
Is our presence there an implicit celebration and blessing? And the answer, I think, is characteristically yes, that's the case. So as a rule, I would not attend those fates for that reason, even though they were close friends. And what I would like, what I would hope would be the case for those people who have this celebration, that they would be respectful and tolerant and understanding of my view, that this is not an act of a personal affront to them, but as a matter of conscience before our God, whether or not we're right or wrong from their perspective, it's a matter of conscience for us, and that they would be respectful. Listen, if I were in their shoes, I would say, man, I can see how you'd be bugged by this, and so I'm not going to be the least bit injured because you are living out your principles in a way that's consistent. You're not going out of your way
right.
to be nasty to
yeah.
us. You're just choosing not to participate, even though you treat us with grace when we're near you. I would like that to be their response, but you will almost never get that response because they are demanding of much more charity towards them than they are ever willing to give towards you. And this is my generalized observation with regards to lesbians and homosexuals. There are probably some exceptions to that, but
I think they would respond positively to us not attending.
Okay. Okay, well, then the second point that I was going to make is the only time I make exception to that is when the couple in question is a immediate member of the family. So it's the parent's daughter or son, or it's someone's sister or brother. And in that situation, I think you have a prior relationship that that it plays into the mix. You have a long-term thing that's going to be ongoing close to the family, and as long as it's understood by the principals that you are going out of respect and love for them but are in no way celebrating the union. Therefore, dad doesn't walk the daughter down the aisle or the
right.
son or whatever, you know, those kinds of things. But they're there as an act of love and courtesy to them. Then I think that under those circumstances that can be justified. But I think it's still
okay.
a tough call. But it's only under that circumstance, and I think immediate family, generally I'd say no. I'm pressed for time here, so I want to quickly move to the second question. I'm also conflicted about the second issue, and for this reason. What I would say, my moral impulse is to say, we don't allow you to sleep together under our roof. This behavior we think is deeply immoral, and it is personally abhorrent to us. And
right.
so to think that we have you in our home and something like that, and we don't want you to act out in front of us. We don't want you making out on the couch or holding
yeah.
hands and stroking
right.
each other and stuff like that. That would be deeply inconsiderate to our moral sensibilities.
Right.
And so I would, this is the, just as you wouldn't allow, 15-year-olds or 18-year-olds that are shacking up to live, to sleep together just because they're at
right.
your house, you wouldn't allow this other thing to have happen, and which I think would be a lot more difficult for you emotionally. And I would like to think that they would appreciate that. But I think it's fair to say, look, at them's the rules, these are our sensitivities, and we're asking that you respect it. Now, if you don't respect that, then we accept that, but you can't stay here. You can stay at the motel down the street.
Right.
But my only hesitancy there is that this is the kind of thing that I think is going to be very difficult for them. So I'm going to have to go real quickly.
Great. Thanks.
Yes, Dan, I hope that helps. Get back to me. Let me know what happened.
Thanks
okay.
a lot.
Sure.
Okay.
Bye. Let's quickly go to Brad. And Brad, you just got a minute or two. What's up? Glad we can catch you here.
Hey, Greg.
Hi.
I'll try to make it quick. Boy, talk about navigating dangerous waters. That was it. I was calling because I think the guy's name was David, who was, desperately trying to place blame and responsibility for God.
Our second call, and he was very confused about at least my views about God take sides or not.
Well, I wanted to make a point. I'm Reformed, and, the Catechism and the Reformed documents basically
right.
say that God ordains whatsoever comes to pass.
Right. That was a little bit different issue than what we were talking about, but you're right. I think he does.
But it implies that God's responsible for evil, and it's against the clear biblical doctrine of God's blamelessness and his purity and holiness.
Yeah, well, I don't actually think the Reformed doctrines imply that. I think they actually explicitly state the opposite if you look at the Westminster Confession. Now, to some people, they think, well, if God does ordain, if he's sovereign in that sense over everything, then he must be responsible for evil that follows. But I think the Reform guys are pretty, those who are careful are able to make the case that God can be in control in one sense, but not be responsible for the evil that he allows to have happen.
That's the point I wanted to make, because I agree 100% with what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
But I think David's primary error is that he's assuming that he knows that the eternal counsel of God, and that sometimes he actually, his perfect will is that government be an expression of his judgment and
mm-hmm.
wrath
mm-hmm.
in wicked government.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he's, in other words, it's just the moral, it's the end good that's going to come out of that
right.
that should carry the weight.
Right, I can see that. By the way, I would use a different term. I would just, instead of saying his perfect will, I would say his sovereign will. You can always say that sovereign will is perfect because it's exactly what God wants, and that's going to come to pass, the ultimate admixture of things. But sometimes when people say his perfect will, they think morally perfect, and certainly evil things are not morally perfect. God doesn't will the evil things, but as it says in Romans 8, he is able to cause them to work for good.
Right.
And
exactly.
So in this sense, he can bring a greater good out of those circumstances than we would have faced without it, And so this is where I think we have to be careful how we talk about this in God's sovereignty, that, like you're pointing out, I think, that God can be sovereign over these circumstances on the one hand, but it doesn't mean that he is and ordained them in that sense, but he's not the one causing them or responsible for the evil that people freely choose to do. Brad, I thank you for your call, and that's our music for the end of the show. I thank you for your company these last 2 hours, or any portion thereof, and I enjoyed it with you. I hope you did the same with me, and I'll be back next week with more, hopefully careful thinking about the things that really matter, and we can talk then. In the meantime, if you're a follower of Christ, try to be a good one and a good ambassador. Knowledge, wisdom, and character are the three categories. You can learn more about that at our website, str.org. And next week I will see you and talk to you. And until then, you go out and give them heaven. Okay, I'm Greg Kokel for Standard Reason. Bye-bye now.